Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I am Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilber, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. Fermented foods are delicious, and I love eating them. But we don't really have great ways of studying them. Usually when we study microbes, we can focus on either the presence or the absence of a single microbe, or you could create a sterile environment and add that microbe and see what happens. But when we study fermented foods, we want to focus on the community instead of focusing on an individual microbe. And that will help us understand not only how these microbes are interacting with each other, but how could this interaction lead to better flavor, a safer food environment, production of bioactive compounds? We have been studying the microbiome of the gut for quite some time, which has an even more complex microbiome than fermented foods. Justin, as our resident gut microbiome expert, what are ways in which people can address this problem?
Yeah, completely right. And it is an area where biomedical research has made some strides just because we need a way to simplify the community, to study it, to make it reproducible in experiments. And so one simple, although suboptimal way that people simplify the gut microbiome or get rid of the gut microbiome is just through treatment of antibiotics. You know, if you treat the gut community with antibiotics, you don't get rid of all the bugs that are there, but you get rid of a lot of them. You don't have complete control over who stays, and you end up with antimicrobial resistance appearing, where these microbes that are now able to survive antibiotics are sticking around. So it's not a great experimental way to go about creating a controlled environment. The other way is by actually raising mice in a sterile environment and doing this from the point of birth, where the mice have no microbes associated with their bodies at all. So these are microbiota-free mice. We actually, for historical reasons, refer to them as germ-free mice. I think, you know, now we think of germs as the bad bugs that make us sick, not our microbiota. We think about, you know, David was recently talking about his son that went off to daycare. And certainly when we send our kids off to school, they're the opposite of germ-free. When they come home, they bring all kinds of germs. But in the lab, when we talk about germ-free, we're actually talking about microbiota-free mice that live in a sterile bubble, and we can administer, you know, one species of gut bacteria or multiple species, create synthetic communities where we have actually defined the microbial life that is living in the gut of these mice in a highly controlled environment. It allows for really elegant, nice experiments. And we actually refer to these mice with an odd word, notobiotic, and that's a word that starts with a G, G-N-O-T-O, which means known. And then biotic, of course, means life. So these notobiotic mice are mice with a known microbial life living within them. And while this has been wonderful for biomedical research on the gut microbiome, the concepts have actually been beautifully applied to study fermented foods by today's guest, Ben Wolf.
Yeah. Dr. Wolf is now at Tufts University and has done some really amazing work in collaboration with Dr. Rachel Dutton to address this during his postdoc. And they had worked on developing this fermented food model to study microbes involved in fermentation. Decided to focus on cheese to build a cheese rind community to actually look at these microbe interactions. David, based on your fermentation expertise, why do you think cheese would make a good model?
Cheese is a great substrate. It's made from the food of life. Like when you think about what mammalian milk is, it is 100% of what you need to grow a heterophagous organism. In the first days of life, milk is all a mammalian infant needs to make itself grow strong, which is wild when you think about it. It is the perfect food. And in thinking about that, you know, you realize that it's not just the perfect food for the infant of the same species. There are tons of things in the world that would love to be able to, you know, feast on that too. And that's exactly what happens in the process of cheese making. I mean, also technically in yogurt production, but in yogurt production, while you're fostering lactic acid bacteria to produce acid that will then coagulate and make the milk safe to eat over an extended period of time and basically exclude life, you drop the pH so quickly that it's, you know, not a lot of things are going to get into it after that. In milk, the coagulation comes from a neutral sample. You use the animal rennet itself, what the infant's gut would technically be using to solidify the milk and make it take longer to pass through the digestive tract so it can extract all the nutrients possible out of it. You add that into the milk before it ever enters an animal, and it solidifies. And once it's solid, you can hold on to it. It's not a liquid. It's not going to evaporate. It's not going to ooze out of your container. You can then form it and then inoculate with whatever forms of life you so choose. And that can include bacteria that release proteolytic enzymes and turn the milk proteins into umami-rich amino acids. That can include lactic acid bacteria that sour that substrate. And that can include molds and even mites that then live on the surface of the cheese, the aerobic region of the environment, and produce incredible flights of flavors. And the thing with cheese is that it's rarely just a couple species living in there, because milk is such an amazing substrate. It becomes this incredible cacophony of voices. So you have, you know, mites living alongside fungi, living alongside, you know, different species of bacteria, not even just lactic acid bacteria, sometimes propionic acid bacteria. And given the fact that it's generally this long protracted process to reduce the water content, so you have this slow evaporation as the cheese hardens in a more aged cheese, and you have that long time frame in which to watch this ecology play out. So, you know, in the study of microbial interactions, cheese, especially when it comes to fermented food, cheese is the best model ecology. You know, we often talk about model organisms, but when you think about, well, what playing field are these organisms living on? Cheese is one of the better ones because of all of these reasons. It is such a great place for all of these microbial voices to coexist, which is exactly why we are looking forward to talking more about this very topic with Ben.
Today's guest is Dr. Ben Wolf, an associate professor in the Department of Biology at Tufts University. Ben, we're really excited to have you join us to get a chance to talk about the work your lab is doing. Before we dive in, it would be great to hear a little bit about your background and how you got started working on food fermentation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here today to chat about our work. So I got my training initially in plant ecology. So when I was an undergrad, I was really interested in patterns and distributions of species across space and time, but mostly macroorganisms. And as I began working on plants more and more, I realized that there's this whole hidden microbial world where we knew a lot less about the basic distribution, ecology, interactions of those species. So for my PhD, I started working on fungi, and specifically mushroom-forming fungi. You probably have seen the little red and white mushrooms in Mario Brothers and sort of in popular culture, the Amanita. That's a whole group that I did my PhD on, thinking about how they can move across landscapes as invasive species, particularly in California and on the East Coast, but also how they evolve symbiosis to work with other types of organisms, specifically plant roots. And at the end of that, I was really happy. I learned a lot. I was working with these really toxic mushrooms that you can't eat. But I really love food. I've always really loved food, and specifically cheese was a very big passion of mine. And so at the end of my PhD, I heard about this lab that was being started at Harvard to work on the microbiomes of cheese and to develop cheese as a model system for microbial ecology and evolution. And as soon as I heard who it was, I immediately emailed Rachel Dutton and said, can I please join your lab as a postdoc? Because this marries both my passion for microbiology, but also my love of cheese and other fermented foods. And we met up at a cheese shop in Cambridge here in Massachusetts and had a great conversation. It was sort of a great symbiosis between scientists because her training was in bacteria and bacterial genetics. My training was more in ecology and evolution and fungi. And so we came together to develop this new model system that has both bacteria and fungi in it and sort of thinking about it from all these different perspectives, both from a genetic and mechanistic side, but also big picture ecology and evolution. And that's sort of my journey to using fermented foods as model systems for ecology and evolution. And it's just one of those things where you happen to be hearing about opportunities and it all kind of comes together. And also just to have really awesome creative people like Rachel out there thinking about these kinds of questions and developing these kinds of systems.
I want to hear more about these cheese systems, though. You know, cheese love aside, what is it about cheese that makes it a great model?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question as to why did we go with cheese as opposed to, you know, maybe some other simplified system, which there are many now. There are lots of really great synthetic systems for microbial ecology evolution. I think one big part of it is the appeal of it being a food. For me, especially, I'm very passionate about communicating science and talking about all the wonderful things that microbes do. And so I could see the power of the tractability of the system to do great science, but I could also see the power for teaching both undergraduates and graduate students, but also the general public. And many people can relate to or have experiences with cheese. It's a very tangible, very accessible microbiome. And so I really saw the power of bringing both the science and the education together in the system. From the science side of things, I think one thing that I was really excited about and goes back to the idea of the symbiosis between scientists is that many people prior to the sort of late 90s or early 2000s were studying bacteria, fungi, and other types of microbes in very independent silos. And what's great about cheese is you have to study fungi and bacteria at the same time because they are living intimately in these systems at really high densities. And so I could see, again, the power of looking at bacterial fungal interactions, thinking about mechanisms from both perspectives, and really uniting fungal biology, bacteriology, ecology, and evolution into one complete system. Unlike the human gut microbiome, where fungi are not really that abundant, although they do play important roles, or other systems, in cheese, fungi and bacteria are sort of equal in abundance. And it can vary a lot from cheese to cheese, but they're both really important and really abundant and relatively diverse. I think the other great thing about cheese and cheese rinds, the specific part of cheese that we study, is that the rind is an aerobic biofilm that forms on this very flat surface. And so you can imagine, in some ways, a bare cheese that hasn't been aged yet is a petri dish. And so it's a very sort of easy thing to think about scaling it down into a lab setting and recreating it pretty well in a lab setting without a whole lot of complicated setup. So those are some of the reasons. There are many, many, many more reasons as to why it's a great system. And we've learned a lot along the way about how it's a really useful system. But yeah, those are some of the key reasons we started the system. And again, this is really Rachel was the pioneer here, said, let's do this, and then brought me on the team. And we worked together to really unpack the system and build it as a model.
Ben, I know that one of the questions that both you and Rachel have delved into a lot and contributed a great deal to is just understanding where microbes in a given microbial community, where they come from. I know with the gut, we think about that a lot, you know, how a baby's microbiome assembles and, you know, which microbes come from the mother, which microbes come from other places. With cheese, you have this, curdled milk that then, you know, in some cases goes off and sits in a cave, in some cases gets inoculated with things. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about both the utility of cheese as a model to address this kind of bigger question of microbial community assembly, but also just a little bit about some interesting cheese stories for how microbes get on the rind.
Yeah, it's been a big part of the last 10 years that we've been working on the system to try to figure out these microbial on-ramps, we call them. Like, how do microbes get into the system to just be there in present before they begin to assemble and mingle with each other and do what they do. And it's challenging work because I think one of the big things I've learned about making these artisan cheeses that are rich in microbes and have a diversity of microbes, it's a complicated process and it can be quite variable across time and across space. And so in a typical artisan cheese producer, let's say they're making camembert brie, which is something I think a lot of folks have interacted with, most of the microbes in something like a Camembert or Brie will be coming from inoculation of the milk, because you really want a very consistent rind. You want that really big white fuzzy mold there, the Penicillium Camembertii. And you also have some other bacteria that are tucked in there. And those are also often coming from starter cultures that cheesemakers buy. But even in what looks like a highly controlled, we call them a manicured lawn. It almost looks like someone has, you know, no dandelions or no weeds growing in their lawn. You do find some wild microbes. And in the case of some Camemberts that we've sequenced from everywhere from Wisconsin to northern France, we find a lot of microbes that are typically only found in the ocean. They're genera like Pseudoalteromonas or some Vibrio species. And so what we think, and we're still waiting for someone to connect the dots, is that a lot of those microbes are coming from really simple sea salts that people use in the production of cheese. If you take the ocean and you dry it out, you actually get dormant cells of bacteria that when they hit the right place and time, they can grow and thrive. And so we think that some of these marine associated microbes are coming in as a vector through the salt that some cheesemakers use. Another big microbial on-ramp is the animal microbiome. So in a lot of raw milk cheeses that are produced both in the US and Europe, the surface of the teat that the animal that's being milked, the cow, goat, or sheep, or whatever it happens to be, has a microbiome, and that gets into the milk, and that eventually can be amplified in the cheese-making process. So things like various good staph species like coagulase, negative staph, they come in that pathway. And there's some other microbes too, some actinobacteria. These are the things that often give like a washed, drying cheese that funky sort of almost foot smell, depending on how aged the cheese is. That could be coming from the animal. I think another important and pretty wild group of microbes that we still struggle to help cheesemakers manage would be the molds in the cave environment. So caves have a huge diversity of fungi. It's a dark, damp place and molds thrive there. And what we find is that the molds that are in these caves are coming from lots of different places. And you can get both good and bad molds in these environments. And more recently, we're finding a really annoying mold popping up throughout the northeastern part of the United States, an Aspergillus species that's coming in, we think, through products like cardboard or other sort of packaging materials. It's coming into these cheese caves, and it is very antimicrobial. So it's essentially like wiping out the rinds of cheesemakers. And we're seeing it more and more. What's interesting is it likes warmer temperatures. And we're wondering if this could be something about, you know, during really hot summers where it's hard to cool these cheese caves, it could be something related to changing temperatures. And so I guess I don't know if I've answered very clearly, you know, sort of exactly how all these pieces come together. We have a general sense for these microbial on-ramps, and we have a good sense if there is a problem in a cheese, which are the on-ramps to look at to understand, is it coming from the animal? Is it a mold in the cave? Is it something about the starter cultures? It could even be something in your salts. And that allows us to think about dispersal and how to control the dispersal process. And really, for a cheesemaker, one of the best ways to control dispersal is pasteurization, right? So if they really don't want that animal microbiome, if you pasteurize your milk, you can turn off that dispersal process.
And when you are talking about these species, like when we think about the gut, I think over the course of, you know, a decade, we've come to numbers like maybe hundreds of species. You know, I think it's, you know, industrialized gut, maybe 200, 300 species in the adult gut, way fewer in the infant. Probably dozens. If you go to a hunter-gatherer population, maybe on the order of 700 or more species. But, you know, as you said, most of these are bacterial species. When you think about cheese rinds, what's the kind of range of different microbial species that are there?
Yeah, so a typical Camembert would have probably 5, maybe 10 species, including both the bacteria and fungi. Whereas something like some of the washed drying cheeses, these are the cheeses that are washed with a salt solution over time, we see that they can have 10, 20, 30 different species of bacteria and fungi living there. It could be something about disturbance. Maybe disturbance helps repeatedly open up niches that bacteria and fungi can grow in. It also happens to be that sometimes there's a re-inoculation that happens in those cheeses. But yeah, those with the washed rind cheeses, which Rachel just had a paper out recently showing a really high diversity. The natural rind cheeses, if you think about when you walk in a cheese shop and you see these big cheeses almost look like a stone with lichens growing on them. Things like a cloth-bound cheddar or a cheese like Tome de Savoie, those are relatively undisturbed. And in those cases, you, again, have anywhere from like 10 to 20 species of bacteria and fungi. This is completely ignoring all the amazing diversity of phages that are probably out there or other types of viruses that probably make the numbers go much higher. But it's usually a relatively low diversity system.
Very cool. And, you know, I remember you had beautiful work on cabbages, trying to, you mentioned pasteurization for milk in cheeses as a way of controlling what sort of microbes are coming in and knowing that you're not transmitting anything in the original kind of substrate. For cabbages, if you're making sauerkraut, this is much more difficult to kind of control, because cabbages are growing in dirt. And you had a very clever experimental setup, kind of similar to us creating germ-free mice that have no microbiome, where we can, you know, add species or at least know that they're sterile at the beginning. Can you just give the listener a brief description of that experimental setup and what you found?
Yeah, so I think, you know, cheeses where you do have a lot of inoculation, I think dispersal is a less of an interesting thing in some cases. Maybe, you know, the cases of these molds that are bad, it's an interesting thing to pay attention to. But fermentations that are so-called spontaneous, where you don't really add any starter cultures, you just rely on nature and the microbes associated with the raw materials, I think there dispersal is a very important process to consider, and variation in dispersal is important. So that's why we started this project on fermented vegetables, where we asked the question, in fermented vegetables like kimchi and sauerkraut, where there's no inoculation, you just rely on whatever is on the plant leaf, the cabbage or other material, you know, how much would that fermentation vary from one farm to another, assuming that different farms have different microbiomes, that, you know, because of, you know, the way manure is applied or other agricultural practices, you might have varying microbiomes in those farms. And so to address that question, we did a couple of things. One is we grew relatively large size cabbages, first in the lab in a sort of reduced microbiome context, and then took them out to farms and let them get inoculated by the natural farm microbiome. And from that work, we actually found that it really did depend on what farm you grew identical cabbages at. You got a very different microbiome and ended up with a very different fermentation outcome. Some fermentations failed and were really disgusting rotten cabbage, and some gave you a very standard good amount of lactic acid bacteria, great fermentation, really good ferment. To better understand that mechanistically, we did develop this notobiotic cabbage system. We didn't grow full-size cabbages because you don't have test tubes large enough for that kind of work, but we were able to grow small Napa cabbage seedlings in test tubes that were completely sterile, and that allowed us to then inoculate the leaves with different combinations of microbes to understand how do those microbiomes form and develop to give you that community of bacteria that will eventually be in the ferment. And one really, really surprising finding from that work is that the lactic acid bacteria, these bacteria that we rely on so much for vegetable fermentation and many other types of fermentations, they don't really like to grow on leaves of cabbage, at least in our system. And sort of, we also did some experiments out in the field and confirmed this as well. They're just hanging on. They get to the leaf. They barely hang on. They can grow a little bit if the leaf is damaged. But we actually found that a lot of them even slowly die if you inoculate them on the leaf. If they don't get to a ferment fast enough, they're losing viability over time. So the leaf environment isn't really their favorite place to be. They really are going to thrive once they hit the low oxygen, salty environment of the fermentation vessel. So that was surprising because so many of us rely on this bacterial community, but it's relatively rare when you look for it out in these farms, and it doesn't grow particularly well in that leaf environment. So I think the take-home message from that is when we do see variation in fermentation outcomes for vegetable ferments, which we hear about from small-scale fermenters all the time, it could be partly due to that farm-to-ferment connection, that what's happening on the farm and the microbiome of the farm could really translate into that fermentation vessel.
That definitely matches up with my experience and my reading. I can't remember, it might have been in a Sandor Katz book, where he talks about the endemic communities of bacteria on a cabbage leaf. And it is really surprising to see how small the numbers of Plantarum and Mensuroides and all these leftover cells are until you shred and suppress all the other endemic non-fermentative flora, and then they're allowed to boom. I remember the first time reading that and now hearing you talk about it. Yeah, it definitely strikes a bell. All of this is really reminding me of, I know it's not true, but I always reach for it in my mind, fast becking. Everything is everywhere, but the environment selects. No, everything isn't everywhere, but it really does feel like a lot of things are a lot of places. And how we treat these environments, or when it comes to ferments, how we craft them, definitely allows these microbial choruses to kind of sing to their full potential. Something that I've been wondering, you know, you're doing all this work, you're going to see, you know, affineurs, you're going to farms, you're talking to, you know, small scale fermenters. How much of your work, the techniques, actually feeds back into these producers' lives? You're basically relying on them for all of this kind of historical knowledge. You're studying what these traditional fermenters are doing. How do the results and techniques of what's going on at Tufts actually feed back to help some of these cheesemakers and artisans?
It's a really great question. And I will tell you, the most satisfying part of the last 10 years of doing this work is not, I mean, I love being in the lab. I love being here and doing the science in this very sort of sterile, controlled environment. But it's really when I'm out in the fields, you know, getting my hands dirty, working with cheesemakers, out in the field, searching for lactic acid bacteria with fermenters. That's the part that I think is the most exciting, because it's seeing our science out in the field and how it actually works in the real world. And so there's a couple of stories where I think what we've done in the lab to figure out these sort of design principles for the microbes and ferments have applied to real world settings. A lot of those applications and sort of solving those challenges have to do with the dispersal that Justin was talking about earlier. Usually the problems that we encounter are where a microbe that isn't wanted in a system, that has some kind of defect that causes a problem for the ferment, has gotten into the system, and the cheesemaker wants to figure out what is that microbe, how to control it, and hopefully maybe how to get rid of it. And that's both in cheese, where we've done a lot of our work, but also in vegetable ferments and some other fermentations as well. So one example, we came across this really strange looking cheese quite a few years ago now that was bright purple, just like the most purple of purples you could ever imagine. It was beautiful, but it was happening to every single batch of cheese that this maker was making. And the cheese also smelled awful. It smelled like rotting fish. It was really gross. And I had never seen purple cheese before. I emailed everyone I knew and asked, has anyone seen this before? I looked in the literature. There was no evidence of purple cheese before. It turns out that a bacterium, a Proteus species, Proteus are notorious in the human microbiome world because some of them can cause urinary tract infections. This particular species was getting into the cheese, growing and making the pigments indigo and indirubin. So indigo, the blue of blue jeans. It also made this sort of reddish compound, and together those were making purple. It was only doing it under certain conditions, cold. It was only doing it under cold conditions, but it was doing it really well because this microbe can spread all over the cheese and spread really quickly throughout a system. We had to try to figure out where it was coming from. It wasn't a starter culture. So we plated out the microbiome of each cow that they had in their herd. And we figured out that it was coming from one particular cow. One cow happened to get this bacterium in its system. And so they took that cow out of production, were able to clean their make facility and their production facility, and were able to solve the problem. So it really goes to show you that there's variation in your animals and in the microbiome. And by turning off the sort of dispersal process, you can really have an impact. Another example, again, from cheese was there was a cheesemaker in the US that her rinds were disappearing. She would make her cheese, put it in the aging environment. She got this mold coming in and didn't get any other rind growth. There were all these divots. The cheese was really, really messed up. In that case, it was a really interesting microbial interaction. So the fungus that was coming into her cave had an antibacterial compound called Serratin that it was secreting. It's something it naturally does out in soil and other environments. And it is a very potent antibacterial compound. So it was coming into her cave, killing all the bacteria. So all the good bacteria she needed for ripening and for flavor were being wiped out. In that case, again, cleaning the facility, trying to figure out where the mold was really important. But for us, what was really cool is that led us to this really cool metabolite and a really interesting paper about microbial interactions, how fungi can wipe out bacteria in these communities. So those are some of the examples of ways that we do this. I'll tell you that at a private institution that's not a land grant institution, I do all this for fun, honestly, or for teaching moments for students, because I wish I was, but I'm not an extension agent. I don't have an extension role in my position. And we don't really even have a food science department. So I really just sort of go out to meetings where cheesemakers or other fermented food producers are. I have a sort of open door. If they send me an email and it sounds really cool and like we might be able to help them, we'll try to work on it for them. And again, I think in a lot of these cases, you can learn some really cool microbial ecology by looking into these defects. When the system changes, goes from a good state to a bad state, what are the levers that are being turned to allow that to happen? And what's the cool microbial ecology evolution that's happening there?
Very cool. Purple cheese. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, you know, the cheesemaker, they were hoping to maybe sell it as like Easter cheese because it was such a striking color, but it smelled awful. It smelled really bad. Proteus makes a lot of sulfur compounds and it smells like rotting fish. So you definitely don't want that on your cheese. Yeah.
Now, you know, speaking about food industry, I definitely have experience in this. And even in my time at NOMA, you know, I remember reaching out to the Westerdijk Institute, trying to get really cool species of fungi. And they're like, we're not going to send you. You're not an academic institution. What other sort of like regulatory limitations do you bump up against working at a university, working at like a certified microbiology lab where you do have to go into the field? Or where are the hurdles that, you know, come into existence when you're trying to help out a producer or you want to collaborate with them and you get tangled up in red tape?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that a lot of American artisan ferment producers are excited about is trying to isolate cultures that are purely local from their own environment, from their own region, as opposed to buying strains of, you know, French microbes, for example, that we often rely on for cheesemaking, or particular strains that maybe have a low diversity or don't have the flavor profile you want. I think the challenge with that is proving that those strains are safe. And there are various regulatory bodies and frameworks like generally recognized as safe. But it's kind of a strange space in that some ways that the regulations support safety is simply that these microbes have been present in a food for a long time and no one's gotten sick, therefore they are safe. That's sort of one approach that you hear people taking. But that doesn't really define individual species or communities that you can use in a very sort of defined scientific way. It's more people have been eating this for a while and they're fine. And so I think, you know, if someone wants to go out to rural parts of California or Vermont or Wisconsin and start to isolate new molds that could be really interesting to use in cheesemaking, we don't really have either local, state, or federal regulations that are super clear in terms of how to go about doing that. If you're working with a species that is already identified as generally recognized as safe, it's a little easier because in theory, that strain that you develop should have similar properties to the species that's been identified and approved for use. But, you know, there is probably a huge untapped diversity of microbes out there that could give us new flavors or maybe even completely new ferments. And exactly how to convince people that those are safe, I don't know. I think that's actually a big challenge right now and something I've honestly avoided having to encounter. We've done a little bit of work up at Jasper Hill, a cheesemaker in Vermont that's always innovating in this space. First, just going into their raw milk and other sort of raw materials and isolating microbes and seeing what is the potential palette of microbes that they could be working with, just to sort of ask the question without actually using them. Can we find native strains of the things that they already buy as starter cultures? And so we've done that and we can see a huge interesting diversity of microbes that are there. But what we have to do next is the genome sequencing, the antibiotic resistance testing, thinking about pathogenicity, because even, you know, a strain that's been used as a starter culture, a close relative, a different strain, may have some resistance gene or maybe some weird virulence factor that could somehow, in some settings, be a problem. And so I know that there are other people thinking about this and trying to figure out the best ways to come up with a framework. I think the thing that I bump into a lot is just folks at a local scale with their own local health regulatory agencies, you know, starting to make ferments in a kitchen or, you know, at a small scale making a ferment. And those folks are just not trained to understand what fermentation is, right? They're used to killing microbes and getting rid of microbes in food settings. And they typically aren't used to people that are growing microbes intentionally. And so I've worked a little bit, but again, it's not really part of my portfolio of things I should be doing, to try to help folks get some data to support that they're making ferments that have a typical microbiome in them, or even just helping them figure out how to do some basic chemistry like pH measurements to show that their ferments are quote unquote safe. But I think, you know, even when something appears to be safe, underlying it, there could be some challenges. We're doing work right now in the lab on antibiotic resistance in ferments. And we recently published a review paper where I at first was concerned writing the review, but then I felt better at the end of it. But, you know, in some ferments, there are antibiotic resistance genes in pretty high concentrations floating around in some of these microbes. These are not necessarily resistant genes that you wouldn't already find in other foods that humans are already eating, but they're at a really high concentration and they're often alive because the microbes are still viable. And, you know, at this point in time, there's no evidence that people are getting sick from resistance in fermented foods, but they could be a reservoir, and certain microbes could be a reservoir for resistance that could be a problem in the future. And again, that is definitely not even on the radar of any regulatory agency. We even bumped into a starter culture that was being sold by a major global starter culture company that had tetracycline resistance in it, like a really obvious mobile tetracycline resistance from just doing some genome sequencing. They had no idea. They were selling this, distributing it all over the world. We called them up, let them know after genome sequencing we found this. They discontinued it and added another product. But even these controlled products that are supposed to be safe could have some issues associated with them.
Some part of this feels, you know, talking about your kind of vanguard cheesemakers, some part of it feels a little bit like ignorance is bliss. If you didn't know what was in your wild culture, if you didn't know what was growing in your cave, but your cheese has been safe and hasn't been making people sick, that's great. But as soon as you start to pick it apart and say, oh, hey, here's this novel microbe, or, you know, here's this one species, let's isolate it, then all of a sudden there's a tension around it and possibly worry. I have one anecdote recently from my work about, you know, at Christian Hansen, there's lots of bacteria grown for cheese production, also salami production. And I remember hearing this one story about a microbiology technician who, you know, was frustrated at work. They're like, oh, I got this real headache of a case. I'm like, oh, what's wrong? And they're like, oh, such and such culture isn't producing the bacteriocins at the right level against Listeria. And, you know, we have to prove that it's able to do that. And I'm like, well, why is that happening? Like, we're not entirely sure, but we think that, you know, in the original package, it was sold alongside, you know, these two other, you know, lactic acid bacteria. And when it's used on its own, it seems to be struggling. You know, we've been able to get the cell counts up in the right cases, but there's something going on there. And I'm like, well, what do you think? And she's like, there was a peptide that was produced by one of the Leuconostoc bacteria that we think was regulating the bacteriocin production in this bacteria. That alone, you know, they were on this like Sherlock Holmes case to figure out what the mode of action was that was causing the problem. But it speaks to the complexity of these communities that, you know, together a whole might work for reasons that when you actually pick it apart, you can't understand or see on its own. But when you have those wild communities, when you have something that's kind of found its own Lovelockian equilibrium over time, you end up with these beautiful products. Are there any other sorts of strange examples that you've seen about communities and ecology that stand in stark contrast to isolation in your work?
I think it's a really great point because, you know, starter cultures and the history of microbiology has really been about monocultures, right? Many starter cultures are sold on their own or mixes of things that maybe don't have a shared evolutionary history. I think from our own work, one thing that we've found, and it's not that surprising, is that if you isolate a community of bacteria that has exactly the same three species from different cheeses around the world, so we were looking at a Staphylococcus, a Brevibacterium, and a Brachybacterium. We found those exact same species from 9 different cheeses around the world. One argument is that those cheese communities should behave very similarly because it's the same species. They should do the same thing. Another argument is that because they are different strains with different evolutionary histories from different places, they may behave really differently. And we found the latter, right? That these look the same taxonomically. If you look at the names, they look the same. And you imagine if you put them in a cheese, they should all behave the same. But actually, these communities had wildly different rind formation properties, different pigments, different volatile productions. We even think different phage dynamics in those communities. And so I fully agree that, you know, we shouldn't really be thinking about these systems in isolation. And this is a big theme in our lab, is we ask the question, you know, what are the parts and how do they fit together? How do interactions in these systems really, how is that the glue that keeps these systems together, that gives them their hierarchical, higher level properties? It applies at the short term, the ecology and the sort of physiology. It also applies in the long term. So another big theme in the lab right now is, how do these systems evolve and change over time? And some really recent work in our lab has found that, you know, if you evolve a bacterium by itself, it goes on one trajectory. But as soon as you start adding in those interactions, you can get very different evolutionary outcomes. In the case of our cheese system, we found that a certain neighbor, when it was living with a particular bacterium, caused the bacterium to diversify into lots of different flavors, lots of different types over time. And we got this huge burst of diversity of morphologies and genetic types, versus when it was by itself, it didn't do that. So I think these interactions are super important. And sometimes even interactions where you don't see a huge change in growth, where when you grow them together, they don't seem to affect each other's fitness, there's still a lot of biology. There's still maybe resource exchange happening, bacteriocins like you were talking about, that could be going on. And so I do think that as we continue to ask the question, what are the parts and how they fit together, the how they fit together, I think from a species or strain level is going to be really important if we want to successfully control and engineer these systems.
Maybe a question for both Ben and David, just because you both work in, you know, with things that people are eating. One of the things with cheeses people commonly worry about is Listeria. And I know there are a handful of other pathogens that can pop up. And Ben, you've mentioned the Aspergillus and the Proteus that can invade and kind of take things over. At what point do human pathogens become a problem where they may be kind of under the radar in terms of detection, or, you know, in terms of appearance and smell, but may cause a problem? Is that something that happens late in the process with storage, or is it something that happens early just with kind of the wrong community starting? Is there a good sense of when pathogens in these different ferments become a problem?
It's actually great that we don't see a lot of pathogen outbreaks in these very open, relatively unknown systems, right? That's, I think, that to respond initially, it happens sometimes, unfortunately. But it's sort of impressive that with this relatively black box approach that many fermenters use, hoping for the best and doing sort of standard practices, that generally speaking, these systems are relatively safe. In cheese, Listeria is a huge concern. It's like the most problematic microbe. And some work that we did a little bit back in Rachel's lab found, at least in terms of the surface, that Listeria actually doesn't grow particularly well by itself. It actually likes having other microbes around. And so, again, I think microbial interactions could play a role. And I think for most cheesemakers, just keeping Listeria out of the cave as best as possible is really the best approach to making sure it never gets there. You can try to have certain community types. You can try to add a sort of culture that maybe makes bacteriocins that kill Listeria. But even if you try all those things, if it's around and it gets there at the right place in the right time, it could thrive. One approach some cheesemakers I know are using are adding these bacteriophages that can kill Listeria. So essentially spraying it all over the caves and spraying it even on their products sometimes as an insurance policy, essentially, to, if it is there in small amounts, let's try to wipe it out with these viruses that kill bacteria. But even that, you know, if you don't have the right phage attacking the right Listeria strain, it could still get through. So really detailed monitoring for Listeria, as well as some of these other approaches like starter cultures that can fight it, or phage products, I think is what a lot of cheesemakers are doing. What do you think, David?
in my work, I always hear it's not kind of exactly the level that I'm involved in. I'm kind of more of a flavor guy, and the microbiologists are the ones dealing with pathogens. But the way I hear them talk about it, it's a race. It's like gunshot, you've made your ferment. It's been sterilized or pasteurized. And, you know, from T equals zero, it's kind of who gets there first. In the labs that I work in, I know that they have like attenuated strains of Listeria that they purposely inoculate these products with in basically challenge tests, and then watch and keep track of the cell counts. In a recent kind of experiment that I was doing, I was adding bacteria to texturized vegetable protein to get all these nasty aromas, like the gross taste of plant-based burgers and stuff. It works really, really well. And then a microbiologist flagged that it failed the challenge test, as well as it was working to break down all these volatile compounds. It wasn't dropping pH fast enough to outcompete pathogens that were there. And these were inoculated at higher levels than you would normally found in just the wild, but nonetheless. And when you hear about outbreaks in, you know, meatpacking facilities and things like that, it's because it started growing on the equipment. And when it comes into contact with your bologna or your mortadella on the slicing machine and then sits in the package, that's where you then see a problem.
Yeah, and cheese making too, that the main outbreaks recently in the US with Listeria are just because people were being really sloppy and they had a ton of it growing in their facility and they weren't doing regular product testing to know when they had a problem. So it's sort of, again, all about dispersal, right? Minimize dispersal of that into your system and into the food and you should be good to go. And you can take all these extra steps to try to keep it out as well.
One other thing that I was thinking of, Ben, when you were talking about this kind of novel approach of spraying Listeria-specific bacteriophages inside a cheesecake in an industrial cheese manufacturer or industrial yogurt or whatever, I know it's super common for, you know, companies like Christian Hansen, for companies like DSM or all of these big culture companies to offer rotating superhero teams of bacteria. It's like, sure, you get the Avengers one day and then you get the Defenders the next. Specifically, to deal with phage resistance in these factories. That is necessarily like the resistance of the phages to all the bacteria in your tanks and in your lines. And so you cycle, you basically reshuffle the genetic deck, and any phages that have actually adapted to be able to take out these microbes and make the ferment stutter or fail or not drop pH fast enough get completely thrown for a loop when a completely new set of bacteria with new genes come into the picture. My question for this novel, okay, let's deal with pathogens with phages, doesn't that kind of then present the same problem? Like if you're not using like a physical, like, okay, we're using ethanol to just hammer the cell walls of these things, or we're not using pH. But when you're using phages, and there could be, I mean, we now know in the last 10 years, the incredible plasticity of bacterial immune systems with CRISPR and the Cas9 system and everything, could you not run into the same problem if you're using phages to try to wipe out pathogens? Couldn't they adapt and then you're back to square one?
This is a great conversation we have in my intro micro course about this exact topic and in this case study. The companies claim that they've done studies to say that these products will not develop resistance in Listeria to them. But if you look closely at some of the papers they published, at the very end of their experiments, you start to get this blip of Listeria that seems to be going up. And I often wonder, is that resistance that we're seeing? I'm not a phage person, but I hope that, you know, someone has samples of Listeria from, 10 years ago, and someone can go out in 5 or 10 years and look to see if there's a higher incidence of phage resistant Listeria out there. I think just like antibiotics, there could be resistance developing to these products, but maybe they'll be rotating different phages in to solve that problem. I don't know.
And what is the role of the bacterial and fungal community in the development of phage resistance? Is it that a more diverse community is less prone to phage-driven disruption? Or is it the kind of development and selection of a resistant starter? Is it that just as effective?
Yeah. Rachel's lab published a paper pretty recently about this, or maybe it's a preprint, I don't remember, where they were noticing these increases and decreases in a bacterium called Hafnia in blumyrind cheeses. So again, sort of Camembert-style cheeses. And those rapid cyclings of Hafnia were due to phages that were popping up in the particular facility and causing the crash of the Hafnia. Typically, when people are worrying about diversity and rotating cultures in cheese making, it's usually for lactic acid bacteria, for fermenting the curd and the milk and getting the sort of solid mass of cheese, not necessarily with starter cultures for the surface ripening. And so I think more and more work as we look at phages of other bacteria that are important in these systems, I think that idea will become more important. There's another paper from a group up in Quebec. They were looking at another bacterium, Brevibacterium, and found really virulent phages that could wipe out Brevibacterium ripening and caused, again, a delay in the rind formation. And they also pointed this too. They said that we should really start adding genetic diversity of strains, not just use one strain all over the world to do this ripening, which it makes sense. We know that from lactic acid bacteria. We know that from other industrial microbes that we shouldn't do that. So we need to start doing that for these other microbes. It is the part of the system that we know the least about, the phages that are in the rind. It's something that Rachel's group has been working on. And we're starting to dabble a little bit. As you know, working with phages, it's like a whole other beast. It's nothing really like working with just bacteria or just fungi. So it requires expertise. But I think it's sort of a future direction for us to explore in the system. And there aren't really phages for fungi, but there are mycoviruses in fungi. We don't have evidence that they're playing a role yet, but there's some very cool work that fungal viruses can completely transform their secondary metabolite profiles, their physiology. There's a lot of wild things out there, I think, in the mycovirus world that may play a role in the Penicillium or Aspergillus that we see in our system, but we haven't dipped our toes in that yet.
And just to clarify something for me, when we talk about starter culture and cheese making, what does that actually look like? Is it like, you know, the little freeze-dried packets that you could buy? Or is backslopping also involved in starting the ferment? And how well characterized is the backslop community usually?
Yeah, I think for most people, a starter culture in ferments or in cheese would include the dry stuff in a packet. And so, you know, when you buy these little packets that are freeze-dried, those cultures are the things that a lot of people would think of as starter culture. The backslopping that you're talking about, where you're using microbes from a previous community of a ferment and adding it to a new community that hasn't been aged, some people would call that a starter, but it's not necessarily a starter culture per se, because in a purified sense, because you don't exactly know what it is. That does happen. There's this idea in cheeses, for example, of a morge, where you are using the washing of previous washed rind cheeses to wash new cheeses to sort of speed up the rind formation process. Jasper Hill has been doing some really cool and very careful experiments with that process. The issue with using backslopping is that you can carry over both good microbes, but also bad microbes, pathogens, or just undesirable things that make the cheese taste bad or look weird. And so you have to be really careful that you're not propagating those bad things at the same time that you're propagating the good ones. It does happen in the US, I think less often in Europe, and a lot of traditional cheeses like Comtes and other sort of Alpine style cheeses. It's pretty common for both the surface ripening cultures and even the lactic acid bacteria that you'd use to ferment the milk. It happens. I just think that the variation, some cheesemakers aren't comfortable with the variation. And also the idea that you could be propagating something bad, I think is challenging for some cheesemakers. Jasper Hill does testing of all that. They even have a whole microbiology team, a lab that we help them build. So they know very precisely exactly what they're working with.
That's super interesting. Just to go back to what we were talking about earlier, the question David asked about collaborating with folks outside of academia that are working in the food space, I'm just curious about what the challenges have been, especially when it comes to funding. I know you're working in a space that bridges microbiology and food science, but typically, at least in my understanding, you know, food science is not considered as, you know, quote unquote, serious of a science outside of industry, and in academic spaces can be really challenging to get funding.
Yeah, it's honestly been a bit challenging, because when I've applied for traditional food grants through the USDA, the feedback I've received is often, A, you're not at a food science or land grant institution, is what they often say. B, these foods are sort of fringe, right? They're a very small market, a piece of the overall market. So we're not really sure the impact will be great. And then more recently, USDA has like eliminated food quality research grants. They're mostly focused on food safety or sort of novel functional foods. And so the work to do, you know, things like trying to figure out how to manage this aspergillus, for example, which I would need just like a small grant to try to figure that out. I can't get that money from the USDA, which is surprising because they should be the group that's funding it. I think they're just not really interested in this work. Where I have been really successful, and the reason our lab is really focused on the basic science, is the National Science Foundation. They have seen these systems as really powerful tools to ask the question, what are the parts and how do they fit together, and in lots of different perspectives, from the ecology to the evolution. And all of our funding has come from the National Science Foundation for the most part. We accidentally got a USDA grant that was actually originally through the NSF, and the money just ended up coming from USDA sort of inadvertently. And so they've been really strong supporters, I think also because they see the power of these systems as a tool for teaching. So we use the fermented food models in my microbiology lab courses because it's a really quick and easy system to teach basic microbiome sequencing, analysis. You know, you can do a lot of things really quickly without the complications of a more advanced system. And then also we've done a lot of outreach, you know, setting up a booth at a farmer's market and having people come over and look in microscopes and teach them about microbiomes that way. So thank you, NSF, for all of your funding. We actually just found out today we got another NSF grant for some really cool work to start mixing microbiomes of ferments together and understand this idea of community coalescence. So so NSF has really been the place to go. I hope USDA sees the importance of these systems. There are these new dairy business innovation centers throughout the US that are funding some microbiology. We've been able to work with collaborators that have that money, but I think that they just these systems haven't really resonated with them, and the power of these systems hasn't really been clear. I also say that the industry money that everyone thinks we should be able to get doesn't really exist either, because most of the people we work with are really small producers that barely get by, right? They don't have big R&D budgets. So even when they get together and have a guild, there's just not that much money to support this kind of research. So it has been a challenge. And you know, the NSF has been able to support the basic science. And then on the side, for fun, I've been able to help cheesemakers in the applied context.
What are some projects in the fermented food space that you've been really excited about recently?
Yeah, I think it actually ties really nicely to what we were just talking about. I think that most ferments we've largely discovered by accident or made by accident. And I think with some new tools and some new thinking and all the new substrates that are out there, especially in the plant-based space, we might be able to create completely new ferments by making combinations of microbial communities that haven't necessarily been put together, by evolving strains on substrates or evolving strains to work together as new and novel communities. And so what we're trying to do in the lab is use this framework of community coalescence, where you take microbial communities that historically have never seen each other, start mixing them together, and try to understand who ends up being part of that novel community and what happens when you put that in different conditions and different environments. What happens when you try to use evolution to make those new communities work together? And so I'm really excited about that. I know a little bit of this is happening in industry in various ways, and discovering new strains and understanding how they can fit together in this puzzle of the fermentation communities is also, I think, important work in the future.
That's really cool. Yeah, the idea of community coalescence, I guess I would have hypothesized that you would just be selecting for certain microbes, or would have kind of come with it with that approach, but it never crossed my mind you could even do just strain tracking and say, you know, look at what strains end up dominating, especially if they're coming in from a different community. Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah. Like for example, if you think about a plant-based cheese, for example, that you want to make, if you took some cheese microbes and you took some miso microbes, for example, mix those two communities together on this new substrate, whether it's soy or cashew or almond, what happens? You get sort of a nice blend of both of those initial communities. How do you need to tweak that community to sort of get a interesting product that could have new flavor properties or new functional properties for health? Those are some of the questions that we're thinking about, and how can we use the evolution, the experimental evolution that we've done to coax microbes that maybe don't want to grow on that new substrate to do the work and sort of settle into that community.
And a fun question for you, Ben. What microbial communities dominate your fridge at home?
That is a great question. I will say there's been an interesting twist recently. I historically have said no to kombucha. I've been a fan of the microbiology, but have never really come to like the flavor. But in the last year, there is a giant jug of kombucha in our fridge now, and I've been drinking. I don't know what's happened. I don't know, maybe the microbes are training me. Maybe I'm being taken over by the microbes. But I've come to love kombucha, which has been an interesting change. I also, in terms of the cheese base, I love sort of simple bloomy rind cheeses. Funky camemberts or really nice brie are sort of my go-to. I also love cooking with kimchi. I don't really like fresh kimchi. I like sort of cooking it and mixing it into other things and for that flavor profile. So that's sort of the typical microbial community you'll find at in my fridge at home. Sometimes there's wine accompanying all that or some salami as well. But at the base, it's cheese and now kombucha. So yeah.
Before we wrap up here, I'd love for you to, since we're talking about flavor and taste, just to give us one or two quick stories about molecules that you've found in these cheese rinds that are important for flavor profile, whether these are things that we perceive that have other roles in the microbial community. If you know what they're doing, I'd love to just kind of hear the molecule to palate sort of connection.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I've always thought about when we first started working in the system with Rachel is that cheese microbes stink. Like our lab smells really funky on a typical day. Pretty sulfury, sometimes a little buttery. And, you know, those microbes aren't necessarily making those compounds for us. Those are probably byproducts of their own metabolism, but maybe they could play a role in how they sense each other. And so I had a really awesome PhD student a few years ago start asking the question, are all these different compounds, these volatile compounds being made by cheese microbes, do they play a role in the ecology of the system? And what she found is that there are some bacteria in the cheese rind, a group of bacteria called Vibrio species, Vibrio casei, not Vibrio cholera or other scary Vibrio, that respond very strongly to volatiles made by fungi, various sulfur compounds and other compounds. So as the fungi are breaking down cheese, they're decomposing the amino acids and the fats that are there. Those become these really lightweight aromatic compounds that we sense. And that some of the bacteria in the system, these Vibrio species, when they grow in the presence of those volatiles, they ramp up their growth really dramatically and respond really, really strongly to them. And this is, again, without any contact with the fungus. This is at a distance. And it's interesting that we sort of found this because back when I was working with Rachel, we kept having these annoying issues with our proteobacteria, which is what Vibrio is, where sometimes when our experimental caves, quote unquote, were really full of lots of fungi making lots of volatiles, the proteobacteria would just like grow like crazy and would be really inconsistent. And so I think what was happening is they were responding to the volatiles. We just didn't know it back then. We think it's actually feeding into their central metabolism and actually the volatiles are being used for growth. We haven't done the sort of isotopic studies to show that for sure, but we're pretty sure that's happening. And it makes a lot of sense to me because, again, cheesemakers talk about that when they have certain types of cheeses and certain densities of cheeses in their cave, they see changes in the microbial communities or changes in how quickly the ripening happens. And so it's so cool to think about when you walk into a cheese cave, when you're smelling these microbial communities, they're actually sort of smelling each other and responding to that. And there's sort of a volatile communication that's happening there.
Very cool. I'd love to hear kind of what's up next for your lab. What are the big things, then maybe the next big thing that you're super excited about?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of work in evolution right now, trying to understand in these systems, as people are growing these microbial communities over and over again in different environments, how are microbes adapting to these systems, adapting to the practices that these producers use, but also adapting to the presence of each other. And, you know, I think it shouldn't be surprising because we know microbes can evolve so quickly, but it's been really cool to see how rapidly microbes are changing their genomes and changing their phenotypes in response to the abiotic environment, but also the biotic environment. And it's not just one or two microbes that are doing this. Everybody is sort of responding and adapting in different ways. A lot of it comes down to the fight for iron in the cheese system. Iron is pretty limiting. And so a lot of the interactions and the stories that we end up bumping into in our space end up being iron-related stories. So that's one sort of big area of research where we're using experimental evolution to teach us about how these microbes are adapting in these fermented food environments. I think the other thing that I'm really excited about is understanding all these metabolites that are being made by these microbes and that we're eating when we're eating these products, both the volatile but also the non-volatile. Like, what are they doing in the system? And so right now we have a lot of projects on fungal secondary metabolites, things kind of like penicillin, but you know, a lot of other metabolites that are poorly characterized. How do they affect quorum sensing in bacteria? How do they affect evolution of antibiotic resistance in these systems? How do they affect just the way that the community develops? That requires a lot of work with chemists. We have some really great chemistry collaborators, but it's a nice marriage of chemistry, fungal genetics, bacteriology, and ecology as well. And so those are some of the two of the really big themes in the lab right now, both pretty basic. But again, I think there's some interesting ways that those approaches can be applied. For example, the evolution work can maybe be applied to come up with new strains or new communities that we could use in cheese making or other ferments.
Very cool. And you touched on this, but just to remind people, I mean, the antibiotic resistance genes we see in microbes are not there evolutionarily because of the antibiotics we take in medicine, but rather to fend themselves off from other microbial warfare. And you mentioned penicillium a few times. You know, these molds in there are creating all sorts of warfare molecules that require antibiotic resistance from bacteria just so they survive. So super interesting to hear about. I know you mentioned at the beginning, you're also super active with science communication, but also run a lab doing cutting edge research. I think the first time I heard your voice before we met at a conference was listening to you on one of my favorite podcasts, Gastropod. And I know they consider you kind of their in-house microbiologist. But I'm wondering for both, you know, scientific audience, non-scientist audience, where can people find more on your work and maybe listen to you? Are there other things that you're doing?
Yeah, Gastropod's a great place. There are a couple episodes, and they love microbes. They even have a microbe drinking game. Every time they talk about microbes, you're supposed to have a drink, which is amazing for a podcast. We also run a website called microbialfoods.org. It needs a little love. We haven't updated in a while, but it's still a great resource for enthusiasts and even producers. I know a lot of people use it to train the people buying their foods of what to expect. So you can get more information there. And we're also working right now on a book. I'm working with the person I started microbialfoods.org right now on sort of a way to help educate people more about these microbes in a relatively accessible way. So stay tuned for more on that, hopefully in a couple of years. Yeah.
I would just like to say that I didn't know that was you behind microbialfoods.org. I used that website so much when I was at
NYU. Oh, good. Great.
So thank you for
of course.
Full circle.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's a pretty, it uses some basic website design techniques, but it's all about the information, right? So thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. And scientists will continue to track you by searching PubMed and BioArchive for preprints and then going to conferences where you're speaking.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, we just wrote a pretty nice and fairly accessible review for Annual Review of Microbiology about microbiome assembly and ferments. It's open access, so anyone can read it and has some really fun images we spent a lot of time making. So I highly encourage folks to understand some of the things we talked about today. I think it's a great piece. So Annual Review of Microbiology, and just look up microbiome assembly in fermented foods, and you should be able to find that review paper.
Great. Thanks so much, Ben.
Great. Thank you all. This has been really fun. I really appreciate that you do this.
Thanks so much.
Amazing. Wonderful to have you on. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us for our conversation with Ben Wolf. For more information, visit us at go.stanford.edu/fermentation series. Or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.